Welcome. You're listening to Refusing to Implode Politely, a show all about London spoken word, with me, Zoe Stegosaurus.
Ogmios. Have belief in what your eyes can see, but my third is telling me different. Barely extant, but its judgment is consistent. Men speak in a borborygmus tones, I feel my animosity twitch. You don't match the words you write. You were not the manuscript, holier than thou, but you won't get a rise out of me, bro. Do you even lift spirits? Confidence, the volume of man's consciousness, right and void of believability. You're like the opposite of Ogmios. He was a Celtic god. Deity of eloquence, he had the powers of persuasion, a striking feature being chains that run from his tongue to man's ear. He had the talent to control a nation. Listeners and followers got as close as they could and hang on his every word. He binds man onto himself, so free thought and action becomes blurred. He is also the creator of the Fictions, which was a tablet that carried a curse which he could pass on to the next. And Ogmios reminds me of Cameron and the Fictions and a privatisation contract to the NHS. And we are the followers of Ogmios. We've been binded. We are the ones that's next. He's also the leader of the dead, and David Cameron is leading us to our deaths via austerity, bedroom tax and increased rent, and the only tax cuts are benefiting the 1%. It makes no sense, but I understand. Ogmios is a psychopomp. He has the ability to control man's actions, but Cameron only has power in the face of our inaction. It's time to extract these distractions and cause a nationwide reaction to this eaten, educated class, this socio-elitist faction called the Conservatives. And what I observe is this: for as long as we continue to grumble without taking reasonable force, he will continue to oppress the majority of society. He will not pause. Civil disobedience is needed. We tried to talk, but our words were not heeded. So, Mr. Cameron, you can hold yourself personally responsible for what we do next, because we are coming for our freedom, and that starts with your head.
That's so good. Ah. It's so lovely sharing a studio with so many talented people. Good morning. Welcome to Refusing to Employ Politely. I'm joined today in the studio by Dean McKee, who is a lovely spoken word poet from London, as per usual. Dean, can you give us a little introduction of yourself? How long have you been writing, and why do you write?
I've been writing for about 2.5-3 years, so like still very, very new to the whole scene, I guess. My writing started was just a vent, you know? Mm-hmm. If I saw something I didn't like, or I had an experience that I didn't like, I would just write to vent, and it kind of grew from there.
So let's talk a bit about your poems. You said you write to vent. Well, it started that way. Is that still the case now?
Yes, I would say it is. I mean, more so now, I'm more open to having ideas and writing to cater for an audience. Mm. But I would still say the majority of my writing is me talking about things that I see and things that I don't like and experiences that I've had that I don't like and that I want to talk about. So yeah, I would say so. 80%, 90% of it is still very much, and if the audience like it, they like it. If they don't, so be it.
So quite personal, but also quite political.
Yes.
And in some ways, I guess I'd say like a call to action for people.
Yeah, definitely a mobilizing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, because I feel like we're the people that can make the difference. You know what I mean? There's more of us than there is of them.
Mm.
Them being politicians, government. This whole thing, and it's not, I don't want to destroy government, I just want to create a transparent government, one that we can actually trust in.
Yeah.
So it's like, what's the basis of humanity is trust, you know, we've got to trust in each other, and the only way we can do that is if we mobilise, I believe.
You start talking about politics, you start talking about mobilising, the way that you present it has got that kind of philosophical element, that very kind of like human, is ultimately it's a loving thing, you know, it's about let's trust each other, let's be there for each other, and let's not lie to each other like this.
Yeah, it's like we need to rely on the person next to you. Like, if you don't have that as a human, when you're crossing all these people around you, knowing that you can't trust a single soul, like, it's a lonely thing, and a government is meant to represent the pinnacle of our society. And if the pinnacle of our society is corrupt, then what does that say about us, that we're letting it happen and we're stagnating and letting it be a thing, you know, and letting it continue? It just shows that if we're not fighting against it, then we're next to it and we're beside it, in my opinion. If you can't be non, you have to be anti. That's what I think.
I mean, it's quite interesting talking about politics within talking about creative writing, because I think so much of the foibles of society that you've identified there, or the foibles of politicians, let's say, and leaders, like, is absolutely runs anti to what a lot of creative writing presents to us. Like, I'm talking about very popular TV writing, TV fiction, movies. The kind of people that we idolize as characters are those kind of, I'll use the expression whiter than white, the people that kind of emerge from this detritus and then are able to save the day because they have that moral core that no one else can quite match.
No.
And we're idolizing that.
Yeah.
That was a rhyme. It's infectious.
It does, it gets you.
Good,
it
I've still got to write my poem of the day today, so June 30. It's good to get in the mood, like,
yes,
this time in the morning. So I guess what I'm saying is, you've got creative writing as fiction, as let's idolise these people, but almost as an alternative to let's have these people as our leaders. Like, if we can distract ourselves enough with the entertainment of this is what we aspire to be, then what we actually aspire to and what we actually do in our lives doesn't necessarily bring that about.
I agree. I think especially where I grew up on like a council estate, there was only two things you aspire to, and that's music or sports. Like, there's only two things you can do. We don't have the option to, I want to go be a doctor, I want to go be a lawyer. That's not in our vocabulary. We're there. The only two ways out is music or sports. You have to be an athlete or you have to be a singer or a rapper. And I think people need to get that. That's what this government want us to believe, is that we can't be anything we want to be when we can. It's like, if you want to be a doctor and you come from a slum village in the middle of East London, then go ahead, be a doctor. You know what I mean? And it's like, they want us to believe that we can't aspire to be a politician, that we can't make that change.
Yeah.
Because we're not powerful enough. But it's like, we are. We all have this light that we dim because people see it's too bright. So it's like, if people find a light too bright, they dim it. But it's like, why not just let that light shine within humans? It's like, we all have that light. If you look at children, they're like some of the brightest characters that you'll see. It's because they haven't been affected by their whole surrounding.
Yeah.
They don't take that in. They just know, I'm a child, I'm going to play, or I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. And that's their way of thinking. And if they don't get it, they let you know.
Yeah.
So it's like, why don't we have that almost, I wouldn't say brattish, but that almost brattish behaviour, is if I want to make that change. And if I don't make that change, I'm going to kick up a fuss about making that change.
Yeah.
I think we should be brats about it. Why can't we be brats about it? But brats for the good, not brats because I haven't got the latest iPhone. Like,
yeah,
that whole consumer ideal.
I think one of the wonderful things about kids is that they do have that lack of inhibition.
Yeah.
As you say, and they've got that kind of that light that they deliver freely to people. It's not a case of, do I know you?
No.
Are you from my ends? Are you one of my homies? So, all right, then you get my light. No, it's just a case of like,
they just let it
abundance,
shine, yeah.
abundance,
and it's infectious.
Yeah, it is.
And I think that's what it is. I think that's the main thing. People are scared of showing their light because we want to be middle of the pack. That's what we're taught now. If we're not middle of the pack, it's the safest. If you're in the middle, you're the safest. That's what I think it is.
Middle of the pack. I've got fuel for writing, thank you. No, it's really cool. Like, what you're saying is very, very true. And that idea, I mean, I've heard it expressed before, the idea of, you know, we don't want to shine too bright because it shows other people up. Or we're concerned about showing other people up.
We're scared of how other people will react to us.
Exactly.
I think we're so scared of how other people will deem us that we forget that, well, hold on a minute, we're the only ones who should be, like, judging ourselves.
We're just going to take a quick break in the conversation and listen to a couple of pieces that Dean has recorded for us.
So this is Whisper. It's funny how something so amazing can be found in a whisper. How a shining light can start with a flicker. How walls made from the softest material were the hardest to get into. Hers was something that intrigued me, because as much as I saw her, she could see me. This left me believing that we're that similar. Or is it differences unperceived and through rose-scented spectacles, lapping up truth? through the sunnish receptacles, but we spoke nigh on every hour and not one moment. Then our conversation became sour, see, we spoke until we became naked, until every inch of our body and mind became vacant, but we never fully understand someone, because if we do, we become them, was what she stated. Her stay inside was one of broken promises and compromise, so I compromised, I'll stay and listen to every word, even if it leads me to my demise, I find solace. Know when I make her smile every day through bad jokes or just looking in her eyes and telling her it's okay. See, in her eyes is where my heart rests as I whisper sweet nothings into the nape of her neck. And when we speak, a month feels like a second. Imagine what we could do in a minute. Even though I know our time is infinite, I wish our calls would never finish. No one understands us. That's why we speak in hieroglyphics. I hate knowing we're a fingertip apart, so I write secret messages in a breath on glass, hoping one day you'll place your hand in the same spot and a message appears out of the blue, and in its tainted breath it reads, well, we'll keep that between me and you. This one's called Fatherless Generation. See, I'm part of that fatherless generation. One of too many around the nation, living in a single parent household where one parent was faceless. So I grew up faithless, angry and nameless, violence pointed towards the anonymous and blameless. They say a lack of a male role model contributes to my bad attitude. They say look in the mirror at yourself, but I can't help thinking, am I a reflection of you? Every movement unknowingly stringed by you, but you're too busy with your real life and your new family not having a clue. Because you was behind bars when I was born. Oh, how I wish I wasn't your spawn. They say I walk like you, so I tend to sit down. They say our smiles are similar, so I sit with an angry frown. Never think about you, I detest. Even Kevlar isn't saving me from you piercing my chest. See, I look at you as my ultimate test, one that I will pass with your death. I feel like I'm trapped in this genetic cubicle, so petty you can't put differences aside and go to your own father's funeral. I look at your life, it's comical. How you managed to yours and nearly brought me down with you is phenomenal, but the difference in me and you now is astronomical, because I was raised by my mother who taught me to be logical. Come back around for a while when I was at my most impressionable stage, and that lasted 31,536,000 seconds. In other words, 365 days, I counted the seconds, because everyone with you was a waste. You were the predator and I was the prey. Funny thinking I skinned myself and you were the one that ran away, but it's okay. I actually become a better person with you out of the way. I found myself, I better my health, even though you're still in this mission of stealth. Stay that way, stay away, don't apologise, you made it your way. Come to think of it, my one parent was too, because you were a piece of shh that left my mum to be you.
So when it comes to your light and how it shines and like your aspirations, I suppose I'll say, tell us a bit about where you're going with this. You were talking earlier about people being made to feel that they couldn't aspire to be politicians. But is that on your horizon? Is that what you want?
No. I feel the politician that I see currently, who I deem that is a politician, I wouldn't want to be that. Because I don't believe people have bad intentions. I believe people go into politics wanting to make a change. But I feel they become overawed by this sense of power, like this sense of power that can affect any human, and it does get to any human when you have that power to be able to like change something. It can either go to one of two ways. You can want to make the change for the better, or you can want to make change for the better for you. So it's like if we look at the wages of politicians right now, like I think nurses' wages went up by 0.1% and politicians' wages in the last 2 years have gone up by 11%.
Yeah.
So it's like just that figure alone just shows that politicians are working for themselves, because they voted, the majority, let's be real, the majority of politicians voted for that 11% rise.
Yeah.
The majority, and that majority is meant to be working for us.
Yeah.
But yet the rate of inflation is, what, quadruple the time the rate of national wage? So it just shows you're not living, like, they're living for themselves. They live in their bubble, like, Westminster's theirs. Yeah. That's why you don't see people from a council estate walking in Westminster. Because we're not welcome there. Same way people think districts don't exist. Districts definitely exist in London. 100% districts exist in London. They just because they don't have the barriers, yeah, and you're allowed to walk, doesn't mean the stairs aren't a wall. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like if I walk down Westminster or Old Street in shorts, tracky, pair of Nike trainers, that whole consumer lifestyle. See what I mean? I'm saying it myself subconsciously. Yeah. Nike trainers.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, yeah, I don't know, man. I feel very unwelcome in parts of London. I don't feel like I would be welcomed.
Mm.
Whereas, like, I'll find I'll be welcomed more in the so-called lower parts of London, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where the council rate's a bit lower, and then so the house prices.
Yeah.
But if I walk through Kensington and Chelsea, you'll see a very one type of person.
Mm.
And if we don't fit that criteria, then you're sort of like, you'll look out of place at all times.
Do you think it works? Do you think it works the other way around? Like, if you've got your Kensington and Chelsea 100%. People going down into the estates, 100%. Like.
But that's where gentrification comes in.
Yeah.
Because then if you look at Shoreditch and you look at even where I live now, West London, like, Shepherd's Bush is gentrified. They're closing down the market, which has, like, been 100 years.
Yeah.
Like, they closed down this pie and mash shop that's been there for, like, I think 150 years. And they closed it down because they want to build luxury flats. Like,
yeah.
And that's not gonna go to any person that's lived in Hammersmith, Fulham for the last 20 years, 30 years.
No.
So, no, I think it can work both ways. The same way they've got their back up about us, we have their back. We have our back up against them.
Yeah.
It does work both ways, you know, and it is.
But understandably.
Of course, to an extent. But I feel like we need to break down the barriers as much as they do.
Mm.
So it's like, if we're not willing to make the change, then they're not going to be willing to make the change.
Absolutely. And I think that's interesting coming from a perspective of a spoken word poet, because obviously poetry, mainstream poetry has, that means so many different things now, but poetry at large has this kind of reputation as something that is for educated people.
Of course.
It's very sophisticated and it's very kind of...
Of course.
You know, you have to have a certain sophistication to understand it and to access it. And now that's really, gone out the window in terms of spoken word.
But I feel some people do still hang on to that. Like, I feel, especially when I talk about politics, I've got a very deep voice. I'm very, like, when someone hears me in an aggressive tone, they'll switch off, because poetry is very, it's very LGBTQ orientated, which is great, and it's amazing that we can have a scene which is so welcoming of every culture.
Mm.
But I feel people will switch off because I'm a straight white working class male poet. Like, there isn't a sort of a box for me to fit in or a box for me to tick when it comes to the poetry scene, you know what I mean? And I did become disenfranchised with it, like, because I felt I didn't have a voice, you know what I mean? Because as a white male, especially in a whitewashed media and in a Western media where everything is white privilege, but I wasn't raised with that privilege. So there may be racial undertones that I haven't felt, which I completely, completely agree with. But when it comes to me, I was raised on an estate where it was 80% ethnic minorities.
Yeah.
So I was raised along with this. I wasn't raised in this whole...
little bubble.
Yeah. Like, I was raised in the real world. So it's difficult when I want to talk about these things. I don't feel like I want to step on anyone's toes, because I want people to have their voice.
Yeah.
The same way a black man should have his voice heard. The same way a bisexual female should have her voice heard. A transvestite, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
None of that matters. Everybody has a voice. But I feel... because I feel almost like I'm stepping on people's toes by having a voice. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Because I'm a straight white male poet.
Yeah, and that's difficult to say in itself.
Yeah, like, and it's weird to say, but especially, like, when I go out, and it's so weird, the stereotypes that come along with it, with, oh, you do poetry, oh, you must be gay.
Seriously?
I've had that. Like, I've had people come up to me and go, oh, you must be gay. No, I'm straight. Like, just because I do poetry, it's not a big thing. Yeah, poetry is a big scene for LGBTQ, but that's a great thing because it's a safe space.
Yeah.
And that's how it should be. But
it's about people bearing their souls. Exactly. So you need that kind of trust, acceptance.
Yeah, 100%. And I feel that's why it draws so many different sort of areas and so many different sort of people, which I love.
Yeah.
That's why I love poetry. But I did become disenfranchised with it a lot. Because I felt like I lost that. I didn't fit in with the whole box, even though it's not a box, but that's the best way I could describe it.
Do you feel I mean, you said you were worried about stepping on other people's toes.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. But do you feel that that is your own, like the things that were making you feel kind of cut out in a way, like that your demographic wasn't right for poetry? Is that something that was actually shown to you by your like reception from audiences, or was that more like
it was more my own thinking. It was more me.
Yeah.
More subconsciously thinking, when I look on the scene and I see so many diverse, amazing poets, and I see and I'm looking and I'm thinking, we always talk about white privilege, but the thing is, I was in that mindset where I was accepting it and I was talking about it, but I wasn't fully understanding it.
Mm.
But now I've come to the realization, like, we need to stand as allies. So it's like it shouldn't be thrown out.
Yeah.
Because a white voice, and we should let people have their voices, but at the same time, we need to talk about it too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, I feel a lot of people can't, like, with the whole hashtag movement, Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
I said, why is it so difficult for a white person to say that? And I completely agree. A lot of white people said, but all lives matter.
Mm.
And it's like, hold on.
Yep.
There's a difference. Like, all lives do matter, yes. But if you're sitting at a table, you've all got food. This one person hasn't got food. My food matters, all food matters, yeah, but their food matters because they haven't got any. We have food.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I find, like, yeah, I could definitely say Black Lives Matter more than most, and I feel like every white person should see that and be able to stand side by side with that movement.
Yeah,
that's But it, I don't want it to be watered down and lost in that whole whitewashed media again.
Yeah, at least for the foreseeable future, sadly, I think it is going to be a marginalised thing.
Of course.
And therefore, don't shut up about it.
No. Talk until it's accepted.
Yeah.
Literally, talk until it's accepted. And when it's accepted, talk about it more.
Yeah. And certain people, when they talk louder. They've got more of a kind of broadcasting voice, system. Exactly. But if those people are saying, hey, this is wrong.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
You know.
Because it sheds more light on the situation. And I feel people are awake to it, but we've got those blinkers on at the moment.
Yeah.
That's what I feel. Yeah, I've got I don't even know my own opinion sometimes, like, where I've just got so many different things floating around in my head. That I don't know how to express it.
That's the kind of condition that we're in.
Yeah.
A lot of young people at the moment, a lot of everyone people actually at the moment, in this part of the world, are kind of being bombarded so much with so many conflicting ideas and so many, you know, people with bad intentions saying good things, people with good intentions saying bad things.
Yeah.
There's no kind of... It's almost like, you know, we haven't got a model to follow. Mm. And we're kind of pulled one way and we're pulled the other way. So I don't know where I'm going with this, really, but I feel like, you know, that's kind of the state we're in. So having a clear voice and saying...
Yeah.
What about listening to these guys?
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Yeah, 100%. I just think we need to accept each other's voices.
Yeah.
And it's like a lot of people, I can see why a lot of people who don't understand the whole Black Lives Matter hashtag and the whole safe space, and I can see why they would become sort of like very, get their back up about it. Because it can be, if you don't understand it fully.
Yeah.
It can be very daunting to take on.
Yes, absolutely.
So I feel it's just about creating an understanding more than anything else.
Yeah.
And then once we have that base of understanding, then you can spread out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Before we go, we should wrap up, actually, sadly. Time flies, you
really?
Know.
Really? Wow, that's
quick. But before we go, can you tell me a little bit about your writing process?
We spoke about it a bit earlier, didn't we?
Yeah, but they didn't hear, so we should say it again. Like, what gets you writing, and how do you form a poem?
How do I perform? Like,
how do you form?
Oh, how do I form? Sorry. It's more music. I tend to find like inspiration in certain lines, and if I hear a phrase that I really like, then I'll just go off that phrase and just let the poem sort of unravel.
Mm.
And then if it becomes something, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
So does that mean you have lyrics embedded in your work?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. If I hear two or three words that... Or even if I hear a word that I really like and I find it to be like a really attractive word, then I'll try and write something around that word, and then a poem sort of flows off it. Like Ogmios.
Mm.
Ogmios became, it was because I really liked the word Ogmios, and I watch a lot of battle rap, and there's a guy named Ogmios. And I was like, oh, I wonder what his name means. So I typed in, I looked up his word, and it was fitting. So I was like, okay, cool. Let me do a whole poem on Ogmios.
Mm,
so yeah, that's how it comes about, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And process, how does it form? It, only like 20-minute thing, like half an hour thing. The longest I spent is maybe 3 hours on a piece. I'm very short when it comes to writing. I'm very, like a Gatling gun almost. Just hammer it out.
Just think
and
it's
then
like,
just done.
That's pretty phenomenal. Yeah, just considering the slog that I had yesterday, I was trying to write a bloody hell. I was trying to write a Petrarchan sonnet, and I just don't. I'm not a good friend of doing that. I can't, because I've always been free verse as well.
Yeah.
And I'm using this month. This is like June 30. I'm writing a piece every day, inspired by movement set up by Maddie Godfrey, and I'm using it as an excuse to kind of explore form, do things
different.
And it's hard work.
It's
a bit of a slog first, but
it is.
Hopefully it'll get easier. What about you? Do you ever write in
classical format,
structure? Well, not even classical necessarily, but just, you know, something structured, something constrained, or is it all just
I've tried to write like stanza and things, and like actually write verse and like beat poetry, but it's like I struggle with it. Like I'm very much, I'll just flow, and that's why I find like I don't have a lot of written work out because I want people to hear it a certain way.
Yeah.
So it's like, if I put it on page, are they going to read it the way I want them to read it?
Mm.
So that's what I struggle with more than anything else, is like, I want someone to read it the way I intended it to be read.
Yeah.
Rather than, it would be great if they could read it and find their own flow. Brilliant. But the basis is I want it read like this.
Mm-hmm.
And my verse is very flowing, like especially when I perform, it's very flow based.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, will that come across on page? I don't know.
That's it. It's not a two dimensional thing, is it?
No.
I get that. Some people look at that and go, oh, control freak. But it's not. It's not just that. It's about the words being bound up in the drama of the performance as well.
Yeah. And I want the words to have their own power, and I want them to be as powerful on page as they are in performance. So it's like, if it's not going to have that power, I don't want it written. It's that simple. It's like, if it doesn't have the power it's intended to have and the power it does, then I don't want someone to read it. I'd rather someone just listen.
Yeah. I think we have to leave it there. Sadly, it's been a great one. I'm just going to leave you with the last piece Dean has recorded for us.
The train line poem. I hear the rhythmic beat of zombie soldiers trudging up the steps to the escalator. At the end of the day, we all have one thing in common. Our destination is the central line of our plan, whether that be business in Hammersmith and City or pleasure up in the Metropolitan, we all know what's going on. Everybody is heading to a district, one that might circle our thoughts, her name being Victoria, but she wants to roll up to Bakerloo's her senses, which only entices me more into what I'm seeing. Guys approach with these underhand tactics, whereas mine are as open as the overground, but she's been saturated by these overused, underfought chat-up lines so much that she's become unattainable. Would you believe that? It's just my luck. I want to know every inch of her body and mind, but she's fell in love with guys that just want to, and she ain't making that mistake another time, so I'm going to have to use TFL Journey Planner to show the right path I can find to make my intentions as clear as the view from the Emirates Air tramline. I'm going to have to walk on water. And I ain't talking DLR train routes, but I'm going to need more than a city mapper to make her walk that way too. See, we met in the circus that is Piccadilly. I notice at the corner of my eyes, I look up from a rhymeless aura of a person my gaze was yet to find. I don't really do this, I don't know what to say. Hi, I'm Dean, and I noticed your aura from a mile away. She smiled and we got talking, and I fell in love with her words, even though her accent was a bit northern. She smiled and said I was just the right amount of southern, even though I reminded her of someone out of a Great Western she once watched, which I couldn't believe. I mean, look at me. I said, so London hasn't made you southeastern yet? No, I just come to work in southwest. Then we started debating on which city was the best. Me? London. Yeah, we got a mainstream sound, but believe me when I say we are run by the underground. Instant connection, no HS2 system needed. It's the first capital connect I've believed in a long time. Could I take you to a spot where we can see the Docklands light? Truly, it's a beautiful sight. Plus, I got somewhere near we can stay, because I doubt you're going to make the last train. Jumped on the Waterloo City and made our way stay the night and enjoy the sights. I tell her I'll give her a ring when I get home, but all I hear is a deafening silence from her phone. A few days went by. I guess I let it go. Turns out Victoria was a troubled soul. A chill turned my spine cold as I heard on the radio she jumped in front of a Central Line train to make the pain go speechless. In shock, I sat. That's why I always shed a tear when I hear the tannoy say, "Mind the gap."